I'm Humphrey Hawksley, and thank you for joining the Magazine Show podcast brought to you by Golster, the experts in health and well-being, with a range of fascinating guests who stimulate, educate, and make us laugh. Hello and welcome to our live audience who are with us now and our podcast listeners of the future. I am Humphrey Hawksley, and this is the Golster Magazine Show, where we're going to discuss and think about how best to modernize, change those familiar mindsets that we have about staying healthy and dealing with and preventing disease. My guest is more than just your regular expert, because in recent past incarnation, he ran our beloved National Health Service. Yes, the chief executive. At the top, reporting to a rotation of changing political masters. What is that job really like? My guest will also tell what the NHS can do and cannot do. How, for example, do we meet those big health problems such as loneliness, stress, obesity, poverty, addictions, and more? These are surely not challenges for the accident and emergency unit in the middle of the night. But then how? And my guest has also studied this question in depth and written a superb book that sums it up, called, I must get it the right way round, Health is Made at Home, Hospitals are for Repairs. Health is made at home, hospitals are for repairs. What a great, clear statement. Our health as individuals is connected to the health of our communities and to societies. We are responsible for keeping ourselves as healthy as we can. Well, I don't disagree with that, but do any of you? Because if you do, put it in the chat. Challenge our debate. And a big welcome to Baron Lord Nigel Crisp.
Thank you.
Just to get the name right, are you Baron, a Lord, Nigel, or Mr. Crisp?
I'm Nigel. Straightforwardly, I thought titles are useful to get you in the room, but once you're in the room, Nigel, please. Otherwise, I'll have to call you, you're probably doctor, are you, or something, Humphrey, or professors in our audience, or whatever.
I don't know. I might have a professorship from some underground university somewhere or something like that.
Anyway, Nigel, please.
Nigel. Okay, so everybody, we're talking to Nigel. And before we get you to the top of the National Health Service and about what we're going to talk about, as a young man in your 20s, you ended up being a production manager at the Treborn Sweet Factory in Colchester. Is that right or wrong?
Well, I wasn't actually the production manager. I was a product house manager, but I was responsible for the production of Treborn Mints. In between about, if you had any Treborn Mints or refreshers for that matter, between about 1979 and 1983, that's where they came from.
So when you were doing that, I have two things to ask you about that. When you were doing that job, did you think that 3 decades from there you would be sitting in the House of Lords and having run the National Health Service, or were you thinking of doing other things?
Well, before that, I'd actually worked for a few years as a community worker in Liverpool. And actually, I've always been lucky enough to do the next thing that interested me. And the reason I was working at Treborn is that it was a privately owned company by a couple called the Marx Brothers, actually, but John and Ian Marx, may I hasten to add, very serious people, who actually wanted to run it. And not as a workers' cooperative, but through autonomous work groups. So the workers rotated and took on a lot of responsibility. It was a fascinating job, actually. And the combination of that industrial experience and my community work experience, and living abroad somewhere else as well in the middle of that, actually worked quite well when I joined the health service in my mid-30s.
So they had a new model, as it were.
They had a new model. It was a fascinating model. It was... It wasn't totally them. A number of countries around the world had been breaking up their production lines. If you were in a factory and doing productive line, you know, can you imagine there was a job which was checking that every Treborn mint wasn't broken and whipping out the ones that were broken with a pair of tweezers? And you did that 40 hours a week. Actually, you could do that some of the time. Another part of the time, you'd be doing quality inspection. Another part, you'd be pressing the sweets out because they're pressed out on a press. Yeah. And so on. So we did a sort of job rotation stuff and tried to empower, if you like, in today's current language, the people working in the factory.
And did it work? Are they still around? I've got no idea.
Actually, Treborn eventually sold out to Cadbury's. But interestingly, these two men who owned it gave a very large proportion of the sale to their workers. It was a really very very impressive family company run through three generations, and eventually they sold out and things moved on.
So my second question about Treewin was, before we move on to the real topic of our interview, is was there a lot of chit-chat about sweets and sugar and making children's teeth rot and people being unhealthy because of it?
Well, go back to 1979, and I guess the issue about sugar was teeth, as you say, as opposed to obesity, opposed to the sort of understanding we have now of just how much sugar is put routinely into food and has been since actually the 60s, because it's a way of bulking it up and making it more addictive and so on. And we didn't have that sort of understanding, I suspect. So, yes, I was conscious that we, dentists wouldn't like the making of sweets. But it wasn't the health issue that it is today, where people recognise that there are all kinds of implications. Not the sugar itself per se is necessarily bad, but there is all kinds of implications of too much sugar.
Well, that's fascinating, because this shows how mindsets change and food fashion changes. So I'm going to skip a couple of decades now. And you get the job as the chief executive of the National Health Service. And I think, is that the same as the permanent secretary in the civil service? Or is
No, those are two jobs. The permanent secretary is in charge of the Department of Health, and the chief executive is in charge of the NHS. So the permanent secretary is the civil servant looking up to making policy, and the chief executive is the delivery arm. Now, as it happens, I had both jobs. I'm the only person who's ever had both jobs.
At the same time?
At the same time, yeah.
Right.
And that is very clearly a political decision by the Blair government to put all the power, if you like, in one place so that they could drive change hard. Whereas what's happened since, there's always a tension between the Department of Health, the civil servants who look after ministers, and the NHS, which is about delivery.
Yes, I was about to ask you, out of the permanent sections, you said for who was the boss, but you've sort of answered that for what we're talking about with you, because you were your own boss in a way in that respect.
Well, the permanent secretary today is not the boss of the chief executive of the NHS. They're separate functions, and both are accountable to the Secretary of State.
At the same level, they can't.
Essentially the same level.
Okay, that's and you went through three health secretaries with one prime minister. You mentioned the Blair government. Did you find in that period that policy changed every time a new minister came in the door? Or
well, there was a great advantage, which is that the prime minister was continuous, and the prime minister took an interest in health, and we also had a 10-year plan. However, having said that, I'm afraid there's a really interesting point, which I, who was not a civil servant by background, saw, which is that the personality of the Secretary of State makes a huge difference. And if you think of my three Secretaries of State, you had Alan Milburn, and I'm not going to make personal comments about them, but about their style. Milburn was very strategic, actually. You know, he had big picture, long-term sort of view. John Reid, who was my Secretary of State for the longest period, was very pragmatic. What works is what we need to do, Nigel. You know, a lot of that sort of stuff. Very interested in your profession, Humphrey. Very interested in the media. He and I had a very good relationship. And then my third Secretary of State was a policy person. She'd come from a policy background. So here I had Alan Milburn, who was biggish picture. I had John Reid in the middle, who was pragmatic. And then I had Patricia Hewitt, who was detail. And actually, you had to respond to those three Secretary of States in different ways.
Yeah. And they are your boss. I mean, there's no getting away from that.
They're your boss. I mean, you are actually accountable to for your expenditure to the public accounts. Well, no, that's not contrary. You're also accountable to the Cabinet Secretary to some extent. You know, so the Cabinet Secretary would do my sort of performance review, if you like. But the politician, they set the policy. And if in the end you disagree with it, you can, you try and form it. I mean, you work with the Secretary of State to form it. That relationship's really very important.
Yes, that's right. So when we hear, I mean, generally speaking, ministers changing in the blink of an eyelid, like they have been with this government, including the prime ministers, the people that are actually implementing, whether it's defence or health or social welfare or education, people like yourself, they have to change.
They have to change
almost overnight, have to change the way they do things.
They have to change behaviour, certainly. They don't necessarily have to change policy, because if it's the policy of the government, and yeah. in our case at that time, there was a 10-year plan. Now, I don't get a sense that the current government's got a real plan for health, if I may put it like that, and therefore it's more likely to shift around a bit. But, clearly there are behavioural differences about different people, because secretaries of state arrive. John Reid, I'm sure he won't mind me saying this, he always had a joke. He said, when I gave up smoking, the prime minister made me health secretary within 6 months. John came into health with a layman's understanding of health.
Right.
From the Ministry of Defence, which is where he was before, and he went on to the Home Office.
Of course, yes, he was, yes, absolutely.
And he went on the Home Office, and he was... For me, he was very good to work with, because he was non-executive, if you like. He said, he was roughly, I'll manage the politics, Nigel, manage the NHS.
Give me an idea, because I'm fascinated, and I'm sure all of us are, is that you're the boss of this huge organisation that we all love, and we clap the carers. It was the centrepiece of our Olympic Games, and we all have contact with it and know about it. You walk into the office in the morning, what sort of things would be in your in-tray? What would you be doing of a morning between 9 and 11?
Well, there'd be a real mismatch. But the key thing to know in an organisation that employs 1.4 million people, plus the GPs, of course, who weren't part of that because they're independently employed, they're self-employed, the key thing is the people. It's all about managing relationships. I had as close a contact as I could with, roughly speaking, the top 100 people. And if each of them had close contact with 100 people, we got round to 10,000. You know, of course I need to look at data. Of course I need to look at systems. But in the end of the day, people make things happen. And you can have two people with the same sets of skills, and this must be true of journalism as elsewhere. This one gets stuff done. This one doesn't. They've got the same background. They've got the same knowledge. But actually, it's how they handle themselves. And, you've got to work with your people. You've got to set a clear direction as you can. You've got to be clear about what your priorities are. You've got to give them scope, and you've got to listen to them. And that's what you manage rather than managing numbers. They have to manage numbers.
Yeah, so the things that we worried about is that somebody who's had an accident, an old person that's a relative might be at A&E on a trolley for 24 hours, that we can't get medicine. There's been a shortage of supplies of medicine at the moment, and all that sort of stuff. Does that detail cross your desk there?
Yes, or not? Yeah, but it does if it does either if it's a high profile thing, or if it is if it's one of our particular priorities. So when we were getting waiting lists down to 6 months, and we got waiting lists down to under a million and 6 months before I'd left, as it were. The last few, I might end up ringing a chief executive and say, John, or Humphrey perhaps, why in your hospital are there 100 people been waiting for 7.5 months? Nobody else in the country is like that. Now, and I'd expect you, Humphrey, to explain to me what the situation was. And sometimes there's an explanation. Don't get me wrong. This isn't about bad people. There may well be very good reasons why one hospital is more pressurised than another, but we've got to have that discussion.
Yes, and so I wouldn't want to call from Nigel Crisp if I'm running asking those questions. But
also rang up to congratulate people, Mayor.
Okay.
They could also ring me. And every Friday, I walked around the NHS. If you see what I mean, I think I visited every hospital, every large.
And before we move on, because I did about the community and keeping healthy ourselves, there was an NHS ombudsman who left just a couple of weeks ago, I think. And in an interview when he left, he said the NHS has got to stop this culture of cover-up and protection. And I think they were talking about some of these hospitals where the patients had to go through a lot of stuff in order to get clarity. Was that something that was around in your time that you recognised and couldn't be fixed?
Well, Yes and no. I mean, I don't know what it's like now because I haven't been there. But undoubtedly, I do remember being grilled. I was grilled six times a year by a parliamentary committee called the Parliamentary Accounts Committee. And I was grilled in my first year on people who had been fiddling, in other words, falsifying the waiting list, you know. So, you know, Humphrey, actually, you'd actually got 100 patients and you hid 60 in a bottom drawer, you know, that sort of thing. And they wanted to know what we were doing about one or two examples of that. And it was, I hadn't been personally involved. In fact, it happened before I got to this job. But it's a real issue. If you put a lot of pressure on people, there will sometimes be cover-ups. That doesn't mean to say that good people will cover up, but sometimes there will be. And you've got to be aware that people will game these things. This is not, you know, the relationship bit is, I always used to say as a manager, I had two hands. This one was holding people to account, saying, actually, tell me the answer, tell me the results, Humphrey. And this one was supporting them, said, well, how can I help you? You know, this is where we need to get to. How can I help you? You know, and there's the bit about, you know, providing the system that supports you to do what you're doing, as well as the bit that says, actually, you know, you need to do this.
Yeah, that's, and let's stick in the NHS for this final bit before we move wider. There's constant talk of reform.
Yeah.
What happened in your, when you were on your watch, as it were, that made it better, and what needs to make it better now?
Well, I think one of the things that we did do was that we drove quite a lot of change in very practical things. So we set up a series of improvement in different specialities. So if you've got cataract problems, your ophthalmologist or the optometrist, the person in the community, could refer directly onto a consultant's waiting list, rather than having to go through other bits. So we streamlined quite a lot of processes. We also involved the private sector, not in making decisions, but in supplying us with various things and so on. So there were, and if you look at the results from our day, three things happened. One is waiting lists were really driven down very long way, and cardiac services improved massively. Not everything did, but cardiac did, and cancer did to some extent, and mental health services improved a lot. So there was some service improvements. The second one is people stopped using the private sector. Up until that point, what was happening now is that people say the NHS isn't working, and if they can afford it, they'll get their cataract done because they can get it done now, not in 2 years' time, and they'll pay the whatever it is that it costs. Well, by 2003, people had stopped doing that, and they were coming to the NHS. That was people voting with their feet, showing that we'd improved clearly there. And patient and public expectation and satisfaction went up. So there was clearly a lot of progress made. Now, I have to say that compared to then, we had new money coming in, let's be clear. New money coming in. I had a lot of political will. From 2001 onwards, really, it was the number one political priority to get it right. So a lot of pressure. Pressure on the people within the service. But actually, Labour had started it well by getting a lot of senior people in the room in the year 2000 and saying, what do we need to do to solve the NHS? And they brought people in, and that gave them two, three years of goodwill. And there was hope. And what I find terribly sad about the NHS today is I have lots of friends in it, and I see a lot of young doctors for various reasons. The lack of hope, you know, people can't see the light at the end of the tunnel.
I mean, I don't know about our audience, and I want to hear from you that are with us here today about all this. Yes, I mean, I just read the newspapers, and you just think, I don't want to go anywhere near a hospital. which is why you should be healthy at home as opposed to heading to hospital.
Hospitals are fantastically important, and the point about health is made at home. Hospitals are repairs. We should get people out of hospital who shouldn't have gone to hospital in the first place. Not because they're not ill, but because they should have stopped being ill. Should have been stopped being ill outside. So hospitals can do what they need to do. Can I just respond to one thing in the chat? I've just noticed.
Yes.
Somebody said dentistry, and I put my hand up. We didn't improve dentistry while I was. In
you did, yes, and there's a shortage now,
and it's worse now.
Yes, keep it coming in the chat. I want to pivot this conversation to Nigel's book, which Health is Made at Home, Hospitals are for Repairs, which is a general topic that we're going to be talking about. So you left the NHS and you actually came up with this phrase, which makes out to be common sense to us all, but expand upon it.
It's not my phrase. It's not my phrase.
That's all right. We'll forgive you for that.
Yeah. It is. I when I left the NHS, I started working in Africa voluntarily. When I say in Africa, in about 10 or 11 different African countries and with the AU a bit, at a fairly local level in a lot of cases. And my colleague in Uganda, the person who was running the Ugandan health service at the same time as I was running the English one, came up with this phrase, as health is made at home, hospitals are for repairs. And what he means is that in an African village, you know, a healthy child is one where, you know, they've got activity, they've got food, they've got a communal life, they've got social life, they've got elders who can talk to them, they've got a nice, you know, in the idealized African village, you had people growing up healthy, competent, and all the rest of it, ideally. And this, of course, things go wrong, you have accidents or diseases or whatever, you need to have hospitals. So this was his phrase. And I think it's really important. It's not just about it's not just about our looking out for ourselves. It's actually about the fact that an awful lot of things that happen to us in life and that create illness, whether it's mental health, whether it's obesity, whether it's addictions, whether it's actually poor housing leading to damp, cold, or indeed hot conditions, whether it's, you know, what's happening to you at work that is deeply stressful and so on, all of these things are outside the control of the NHS. It can do the repairs. But actually, health and disease are created at home and in the community and in the workplace and in the temple and in the school.
And do you have any? I want to go through each of them in a minute. But do you have any idea that if, say, our loneliness, our socialness, our houses were right, if all that was fixed, what percentage or how much would that help the NHS?
Well, there'll be some people on this video who will be aware of the something called the social determinants of health. So this is the question of what determines your health. And part of it is your genes. So you're just born with who you are. Part of it's your education and that leads to your behavior. Part of it is your environment in all kinds of different ways. Part of it's your social environment and so on. And people have got better understanding over the last 50 years of the social determinants of health. And what they say, and different people say slightly different things, that somewhere between 65 and 80% of our health is determined by things that the NHS can't touch.
65%. And is that all ages or is that just our generation, Nigel?
No, I mean, that's an interesting question. I don't think I know the answer, but it is the population as a whole. And of course, illness tends to be amongst the older lot. If I wanted to say that, it'd be that. But the stuff that makes you healthy, if that's what you'd like to go on to. I mean, we talk about the causes of disease, and it may be air pollution, it may be damp, it may be whatever. But we all don't talk enough about the causes of health. And we now have quite a lot of evidence about what the causes of health are, and they are things like actually having a social connection, having some kind of social life, having a meaning and purpose in life. I don't know, you know, common English language produces this, you know, I get my life back together, I want to do things.
Yes, yes.
All these sort of things.
And given that, you know, many of us, have very busy lives and we're rushing, particularly in sort of if your 30s or 40s, raising a family and all that sort of thing, is it in the public consciousness what you're saying that
It's not in this form, but actually it's surprising that for some people it is. I mean, there's a lot of people who talk about holistic health and so on. And I suspect you've got a highly educated audience. I suspect there's a lot of people who have their views on what creates health. But there is now a lot of evidence. One of the things that's good, and I think people are getting, you see it on Gardner's world all the time now, is nature. Contact with nature is just plain good for you. Actually, it changes your mood. You know, there are physiological changes that happen as a result of being in a green, calm environment. You know, it's just good for you. So all this stuff about people doing gardening, or which I happen to be a gardener, or walking in nature or hugging trees and stuff, actually, which quite a lot of people do, all those things, particularly gardening, or fishermen who sit by the bank for, you know, hours at a time, whether they catch anything or not, or fisher people, I should say, fisher.
So I asked you what you did of the morning when you went in to run the NHS. I'm going to ask you now of your generation, how do you structure your day or your week so that you touch base with all these elements that create good health?
Well, I'm enormously privileged that at the age of 72, I've still got an occupation, even in being in the House of Lords. So I have networked. you know, I have some sort of meaning and purpose in life, depending on what you think about backbench, non-elected members of the House of Lords, and so on. So, you know, I get all of that. I do a number of other things, but I'd still do quite a lot in Africa. But I also am a gardener and do quite a lot of other stuff.
So what gets you out of bed in the morning? Do we need a sense of purpose every morning to actually get up with a spring in our step?
Well, just look at the language we use. Yes, I think is the answer. You know, I need a reason to get up. The reason to get up may be your dog. You know, that meaning. There's a study in the Journal of the American Medical Association, which is equivalent to the BMJ, and it's probably about 5 years ago now, which actually, to the surprise of the people doing the study, this is a research medical journal, people who said they had a meaning and purpose in life did better both at resisting disease and recovered quicker. And a social network, you see the same impact. So social network, meaning and purpose in life, obviously exercise, obviously eating appropriately and not overindulging in alcohol or anything else you shouldn't overindulge in, nature. There's a few things. I haven't yet seen anyone who's really done the compendium of what all the things are. But what you've seen in the last 10 years is people who've been able to put the physiology behind that, the science behind it, which actually shows why being in nature impacts on you physiologically and not just it feels nice or whatever. And I think we need to get much more serious about understanding these, because what I talk about in that book is about creating health, which is, for me, creating the conditions for people to be healthy.
Mm-hmm. It's fascinating. You talk about, you know, you're employed and you've got the House of Lords, but is it an individual thing so that I might be, you know, fascinated in nature? I might want to go flying or train spotting or something like that. And that is the same spring in the step that brings to go and fire away in a House of Lords debate.
Well, I mean, you know, there's something called the U3A, isn't there, which a number of my friends, University of the Third Age, are members of, and I suspect a number of your audience are members of. You know, that clearly does that for people.
Right? Yes. This is, just to sort of finish on this idea of purpose, if we feel adrift and not quite sure what the next week or day is going to begin, we should identify something that we really want to do and achieve.
Well, sometimes you need to motivate yourself to get out of the house, don't you? Or to be bold enough to go and join that choir or whatever. This is where actually the health system can sometimes help. You've heard of, and again, your audience would have heard of social prescribing, which is GPs, instead of prescribing pills, can actually prescribe to somebody who may have a lung problem, joining a choir, because actually doing some singing, not necessarily the highest quality necessarily, if you join the right choir, you can find a choir of your standard, rather than aspiring to the top, as it were. But that gets you out of the house. It gets you into a social activity. And sometimes you need that nudge from people outside to do it. Maybe you've got a bit stuck. And I think that is something that social prescribing has done. Or it may get you into a gardening group or something like that.
Yes. And we were doing on Golster, we had a guest on who was a gastroenterologist. Right. And she'd also won the Master Chef of the Year competition. So she got good food and knew what happened to it after we'd eaten it. She worked at St. Mary's Hospital. Saliha Ahmed is her name. And she said that she had a struggle talking to the doctors, particularly about that. So they will look for somebody who's obese or not eating the right food and give them some medication to fix them.
Yeah.
But when you go to, let's have a nutritious diet so you don't get into that situation, she had problems getting that through. Did you, if you had the conversation you've just had about purpose when you were running the NHS, would people have listened, apart from you being the big boss, would they have understood what you were talking about?
Would I have understood it? You know, I mean, this is 20 years ago, and I was appointed in a crisis. We had what was a crisis then, there's a crisis now, there's a real crisis in the NHS, which is worse. But I was appointed in a crisis with a real focus to improve the health service bit, the health care bit. Whereas now, because I've worked in Africa partly, I have to say, I know we'll come and talk about that, I have a view about health as opposed to healthcare, and health is healthcare, really important, and great professionals do that. Prevention of disease also really important. We should, control air pollution, particularly around children, but also about creating health. And I simply wouldn't have made that set of divisions 20 years ago. I don't think it would have.
And you were talking about Africa. When you were working in Africa, where they don't have the sort of institutions that we have here, is there more awareness about that, that they have to keep healthy because there isn't a backstop?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, it was interesting that this man, Professor Francis Omazwa, who, as I say, ran the Ugandan health service at the same time as I did, he was actually trained as a cardiac surgeon in this country, but he never did cardiac surgery. He got back to Africa and he realized that the problems were all social things. They were all, you know, that of course there was a need for cardiac surgery, but actually there was a need for clean water. There was a need for decent housing. There was a need for educating the public in terms of how to separate clean and dirty water in some ways. So there's been much more emphasis in Africa on these sort of things because they can have the biggest impact. Now, there are, I need to be careful, there are 53 African countries, so let's be careful that I'm only talking about the ones I know. And the biggest issue there in many places was maternal mortality, which was women dying. Now, what was needed was to make sure that women, when they were delivering, had access to some kind of professional help, often a midwife.
Did you learn more from Africa that you could bring to this country than your experience could bring to Africa?
Oh, it's two-way. I'm patron of something called THET, which organises a lot of partnerships between UK hospitals and so on. Let me give you two examples. And we learn, and our clinicians remember, I remember a radiologist from Oxford actually saying to me that after 2 weeks in Africa, she remembered why she became a doctor in the first place. She was about 55 at the time or something like that. All that enthusiasm that got her there as a young doctor, to some extent gets beaten out of you if you're doing the same, you're looking at all those x-rays day in, day out for 20 years. And she found herself with a sick child, you know, and she had to do something rather than be able to call on everyone. So there was a lot. Let me give you two quick examples, if we've got time, things we've learned. One is that we are adapting in this country now, is that across Africa, there are people called community health workers, almost always village women, who know how to do 20 things. 10 of them are preventative, and they may include things like family planning, and 10 of them are treating stuff. We have now started in parts actually of the Borough of Westminster in London to introduce community health workers on this model. And these are people who, in your neighbourhood, they visit every house in the neighbourhood once a month. They talk to you. And they're local people, so they're talking on the same level as you, if I would like that. You know them. They're not some guy in a suit or some woman in a white coat or whatever. They're neighbours, and they say, you know, have you got any health issues? Or, you know, have you got your, did you go and get that vaccination? What are you doing about family planning? What are you doing about, you know? So they, and those are starting to develop in this country. And it wouldn't surprise me at all if in 15 years' time, a lot of practices had community health workers who did precisely this. A bit like, again, people in the audience will know about health visitors. A bit like health visitors did and still do to some extent with new mothers.
Yes, I was going to say that this happens with newborns, and then it drifts away. And are these volunteers?
No, they're paid. They have 6 months training.
Yes,
okay. And they are, you know, good jobs in that sense. And they're people who know their community, and of course you have to sort of manage some issues around, you know, neighbours knowing too much about you or whatever. But there's a lot of experience to grow on. And interestingly, the example that's being used in Westminster is actually using the Brazilian model, which is very similar to the African model. And they are, and the new community health workers were being mentored over Zoom with Google Translate between Portuguese and English. Now, can you, you know, this is what you can do today. You can do
yes. that. Yes. So this would be if I was in a funk, as it were, and couldn't be bothered to do anything, and then this community person would come along and say, well, why didn't you join the choir, or why didn't you go and join this walking group or something like this?
Well, they could do, or when you'd limped to the door, they might say, why are you limping? And you would show them the ulcer on your leg or something. You say, well, you better get down to the GP.
Right, okay.
Or whatever, or you know, a skin lesion or something.
Yes.
I mean, they may be able to, it's not just the social aspects, it's actually also about making sure that the people come because there's a lot of people who don't try to go to the GP. Yeah. They're mainly men.
Yes, yes. So I was doing an interview once with a big family, and they said, well, he'll never go to the GP because he thinks going to GP is the first step to the morgue.
So, yeah. or somehow asking for help is unmanly.
Now, we've got a lot of questions coming in. What we're going to do is, because Nigel has been so fascinating, we're going to save those for after we stop recording. And then we're going to have a free-for-all. But there was one that I wanted to put in from Annam, which, retire, yes, but part-time employment also, yes. So never completely retire, I think this is what Annam is saying.
Well, I mean, my children still want to know what I'm going to do when I grow up.
And a quick thing I did, a couple of quick things before we, is that this idea of long-term conditions that we have, because we're all living longer, and I might have a sort of a rusty elbow or something like that, but it doesn't mean to say that my life is going to be cut short. This is something, isn't it, that's newish to the NHS burden?
It's a change burden. In 1948, cancer killed you, heart attacks killed you, partly, there was a lot of infectious diseases around. Today, with the exception, obviously, of COVID and a few others, and TB coming back, it's not infectious diseases that kill you. Cancer has become, in many cases, a long-term condition. You live for many years with your cancer, and with prostate cancer, a lot of more men will die with prostate cancer rather than from prostate cancer. The burden of disease, if you like, has changed. And most of us, when we're in our 70s or whatever, will end up having some kind of long-term condition that, you know, maybe you're sort of drifting downhill I can put it like this, rather than falling off the perch in there.
Yes. And that is something when you say health is home and hospitals to repair, is that we will need to go to hospitals for that. Yes. And
well, in the end, you will. But you see, what happens and what's happening with our hospitals at the moment, my friends in the NHS tell me, is that a lot of older people do drift downhill. They may get a urinary infection, have an acute episode and end up in hospital. But actually, if you can care for them in the community and maybe even anticipate or spot the first signs of a problem and head it off, then you can perhaps keep them in their own home, which will be better. Because we're all on this sort of, I'm trying to see where my hand is. We're all on this sort of slow slope downhill, I'm afraid to say. But every so often it falls off a step and you go down a level. And because it's long-term conditions, you know, they're much better cared for in the community. Some input, I mean, diabetes is another one where you want some input from, you know, the specialists. But actually, awful lot of this is going to be nurse-led. And often quite specialist nurses, and our nurses are I'm sure, been very good, but there are more and more people with degree level nursing who will be specialists in diabetes or cardiology.
Is your successors at the NHS, they are aware of this, obviously. Are they doing the necessary reforms to be able to handle it?
Well, the biggest issue here is not my successors as such, is that we haven't shifted the system, but we haven't shifted the professional education yet either. And I think one of the big underlying issues is for all this stuff that I'm talking about, which is that we need our hospitals, we need them to be able to operate really as well as they can do. If I've got nasty cancer, I want the best person in the world to be handling it, you know, and same for everybody. but actually, an awful lot of people would be better cared for elsewhere. So we do need to shift that. But we do need to shift the professional mindsets too. And I'm working with a group of young doctors and nurses who are trying to do that. Because if our professionals think that it's all about doctors and nurses and hospitals, then we as the public will follow their lead, won't we?
Yes. Can I ask you to sit tight for a couple of seconds and to tell our wonderful audience what is coming up? Then we're going to come back to you for a compelling summing up before we open up to the audience. Coming up next Tuesday, Kendra Dodd, all from across the pond in the United States, on the power of communication. How do we get ourselves heard? It's important that we get ourselves heard. How do we do that? April 30th, Lucinda, The Food of Love, by Anthony Capella. This is the book of the month, The Sensuality of Food and Its Preparation. Now, there's a purpose I can see for a lot of people. James Ray, Dr. James Ray, an emergency medical consultant, How to Keep People Out of Accident and Emergency, along the lines of what we're talking about today. And then on May the 12th, I'm hosting a Goldster Immersive on this topic of purpose with guests both familiar to our audience and new ones, David Mark, Maggie Pickett, and others. May the 14th, Alf Collins, a specialist in personalized care and the relationship between patients and healthcare professionals. And then May 21st, we go slightly off-piste here, Sir Julian Brazier, former Member of Parliament in the government and Territorial Army Special Forces. We've all seen the headlines, but how can we all keep our country safer? Should we learn first aid, self-defense, that sense of community? Should we join the military reserves? How do we keep our country safe? That's May 21st, Sir Julian Brazier. Should we all learn first aid, Nigel?
Well, I think we should have enough first aiders around, but also mental health first aiders. And some companies have introduced mental health first aiders, who are people who can actually spot that your colleagues' antisocial behaviour is actually not just their own antisocial person, but actually there's something going on and has been trained to sort of, as it were, see if they can find some help for them.
So sort of being aware of, you know, how to help somebody if they're hit down by a car, and also how to help somebody if they're acting strangely in the office.
Yeah, in many ways, that's it. You need to be aware of these things as well. I think both are important.
Okay. Give us, finally, for our podcast listeners, give us a compelling end thought that sums up the past 45 minutes.
Well, one that occurs to me, one of the ones that I learned and I do put into the book, is the point about being in control of your life. you actually talked, once or twice you wanted to ask me about, isn't this all about people doing things themselves? Well, it's not necessarily people doing things themselves, but it is about people being more in control in their lives. And when we encounter the health service, too often, however confident we are, we're turned helpless, and we're sort of, pathetic. I speak personally here. And actually what you need is to have much more of a sense of control and autonomy, and not feel that everything is desperate. And that is good for your health. Just being autonomous is good for your health.
And that's changing our own mindset to that sense of our own destiny. That is fantastic. Our live audience is going to stay with us to talk directly to Lord Chris, but Time's Wing Chariot is attacking our podcasters. So thank you all for taking part. Thank you for your comments, questions, and the challenges that you gave us. What a topic we've discussed. Until next Tuesday with Kendra Dodd and Getting Heard and Understood, think about what Nigel Crisp has taught us today. Stay active, be social, get involved, know your purpose. And of course, stay Goldster. Tell your friends, colleagues, and family, even your enemies, about us. And thank you, Lord Nigel Crisp, for such a captivating and illuminating discussion. And we hope to see you again on Goldster. You've been listening to a Goldster Magazine Show podcast. Check us out on www.goldster.co.uk. We hope to tempt you, your family, and friends into the exciting world of helping everyone live healthier and happier for longer. Find more podcasts just by Googling Goldster and podcast. I'm Humphrey Hawksley and hope you're with us again soon.